Campbell's Soups bring you Edward R. Murrow with the news.
Oh, the handiest thing on your kitchen shelf is Campbell's Tomato Soup.
It's handy as soup, Mother. Handy as tomato sauce, too. Yes, Campbell's Tomato Soup, the soup most folks like best, makes the best tomato sauce you ever tasted. That's just one of the reasons Campbell's Tomato Soup is the handiest thing on your kitchen shelf. For a smooth, lively tomato sauce full of ripe tomato flavor, simply open a can of Campbell's Tomato Soup, heat as is, don't add a thing, and pour it on. It's delicious over scrambled eggs, hamburgers, veal cutlets, frisch croquettes, all sorts of dishes. And this same tomato sauce is also delicious as an ingredient in any recipe that calls for tomato sauce. The handiest thing on your kitchen shelf. That's Campbell's Tomato Soup. So keep a good supply on hand. And often, both for soup and for sauce, reach for Campbell's Tomato Soup. The handiest thing on your kitchen shelf. America's favorite newscaster, your Campbell newscaster, Edward R. Murrow, is in London. We'll hear from him in a moment. Now here's Larry Lesser.
Here's what happened today. The nation's worst coal strike entered its third week, and its effects are snowballing across the nation. The government is making a desperate two-pronged effort to get the miners back to work. The federal contempt trial today went slowly. The union pleaded innocent to disobeying the no-strike order, insisted that no strike has been called, that each of its 372,000 miners individually decided to knock off work. Contract talks continued, but they lasted only 45 minutes before they were recessed. Some of the negotiators had to testify at the trial. The steel industry began shutting down in earnest. The new cutbacks threw 170,000 persons out of work in addition to the miners. The Army ordered its installations to cut their coal consumption, troops to be quartered in the minimum number of buildings, and building temperatures to be reduced by 10 degrees. Only hospitals are exempt. In Paris, 1,500 strikers clashed with police tonight. A strike vote is being taken throughout French industry from the spinning mills of Lille to the docks of Marseille. Well, that wild leopard is still at large in Oklahoma City. Zookeepers, Marines with walkie-talkies, and amateur hunters fanned out on several sides of the city without spotting the jungle-bred beast. A trained pack of mountain lion dogs was flown in from Colorado, but all they ate tonight was dog food. They tracked the leopard back to the zoo and then lost the scent. An Army helicopter was also unsuccessful. The hunters became so weary today that the search almost bogged down. But Oklahoma City is keeping its children indoors, remembering that the big cat doesn't seem to have eaten for the past 48 hours. The Senate tonight decided to erase government price guarantees on the 1951 potato crop, unless farmers agree to rigid marketing quotas aimed at keeping production within what are called reasonable grounds. It approved larger plantings of wheat and cotton. Americans ran into trouble in the Orient today. Two American ships were air-bombed in the communist Chinese port of Tsingtao. United States Line reports its 8,000-ton freighter Pioneer Dale was bombed and strafed as it approached the port. One crew member was slightly injured. The master of the Isbrancent Line's flying clipper says his ship were attacked while anchored in Tsingtao. The State Department says it assumes the attacks were made by Chinese nationalist planes, that the nationalists are trying to extend their blockade to the communist-controlled northern ports. That blockade is not recognized by the United States. Previous protests to Formosa have been disregarded. Two of our allies in the Far East growled at each other today. Liaquat Ali Khan, Prime Minister of Pakistan, blamed the Hindus for the terrible race riots in Bengal. Said, "If India wants war, she'll find us fully prepared." He charged that Pandit Nehru's recent statements blaming Pakistan's Muslims were a threat to his country. Nehru had said without elaboration that if India's proposals were not accepted, India would have to adopt other methods. We'll leave it to the State Department to interpret today's news from Indochina. The Soviet-recognized Ho Chi Minh has acknowledged Yugoslavia's recognition of his communist Vietnam Republic. It may mean that Marshal Tito is afraid to get too far off base, or that Ho Chi Minh is not exclusively loyal to Moscow. The commander-in-chief of the Chinese Communist Armies recognizes some obstacles to his ambitions. Beiping Radio said today that he gave a delegation of Tibet left-wing leaders a message asking the Tibet people to build some roads so the communist armies could march in. Looks as though the Chinese communist appetites are bigger than their logistics. Army investigators probing the strange death of American naval attaché Eugene Karp have yet failed to turn up any solid clues. American military authorities are still questioning passengers on the Orient Express from which Captain Karp fell or was pushed last week. The only things we're positive about, they said, was that Captain Karp didn't drink and did not commit suicide. Authorities now think the Balkan mystery may never be solved. Well, a near tragedy was averted 20,000 feet over Miami today. A quick-thinking crew member grabbed stewardess Josephine Pooh as she was being sucked through a broken window of the airline's pressurized cabin. The Pan American Constellation was on a ferry flight when the window blew out. From London tonight, Ed Morrow reports that the British political leaders are still recovering from last Thursday's election. Here's his report, recorded within the hour.
This is London. An English friend of mine said today that he was going to the horse races. He expected to find them rather dull after the one that ended last Friday. A most discreet silence has fallen upon the leaders of all three political parties. They have been seeing their chief lieutenants, but there has been no direct contact between the parties. Mr. Attlee is reshuffling his cabinet. Don't expect any major changes. The top men, Ernest Bevin, Sir Stafford Cripps, Herbert Morrison, and the rest will remain. The members of all parties are now the prisoners of their leaders until a major issue arises. Developments over the weekend made it apparent that no one wants another national election now. The party workers are tired. The campaign funds have been spent. And there is no reason to think that another poll would alter the political balance substantially. Both the major parties blame the Liberals for splattering candidates all over the political map when they knew they didn't have a chance to win. Both claim the Liberals took votes from them. But if 80% of the people who voted Liberal were to vote Conservative in a new election, it would merely serve to bring Mr. Churchill to power with a majority no larger than the one Mr. Attlee now has. But the overwhelming argument against an immediate election is that there is not an issue, except the basic one upon which the people divided almost evenly. The result is that the next few weeks or months will be devoted to finding or creating an issue upon which one party or the other believes it can win. This situation will produce some masterful maneuvering. Mr. Clement Attlee has a slight advantage because he will probably be able to choose the issue upon which he will accept or even welcome defeat. Mr. Churchill, on the other hand, must avoid defeating the government in Parliament on some issue which would not have wide appeal to the general electorate. The personal relationship between these two skillful but wholly dissimilar politicians is one of mutual respect. They worked together in remarkable harmony during most of the war. And they did not blackguard each other during the recent election or the one in 1945. In certain areas of government, probably including the budget and certainly foreign affairs, they will probably be able to reach an accommodation. There is a well-worn phrase in this country: the king's government must go on. But while it goes on, Attlee and Churchill will be watching for that favorable issue upon which they think they can again appeal to the electorate in the hope of breaking this near deadlock. Mr. Winston Churchill has patience and courage at cards. Mr. Attlee, a cool and imperturbable little man, has a fondness for crossword puzzles. It will be an unorthodox but fascinating game to watch. One thing should be made clear about the conduct of business by this Labour government. It will not be an hour-by-hour or day-by-day danger of defeat. Mr. Attlee can, if he chooses, announce that he will make only major legislation the subject of a vote of confidence. And on such occasions, he will have to muster his majority. But on minor matters, such as a bill to increase the number of employees in a national museum, he simply won't accept defeat, or rather, he will not regard it as an adequate reason to resign and call an election. The Conservatives, on their side, will have to be careful not to defeat him on small, unimportant issues. Otherwise, he might call their bluff, call a general election, and try to persuade the country that the conservatives, through petty party politics on unimportant issues, are making it impossible to carry on the king's business. For unless he is beaten on a vote of confidence, the choice as to when and on what issues he will fight the next election remains in Mr. Attlee's hands. The British Constitution, being unwritten, is a wonderfully flexible document, amply adequate to provide for the carrying on of the king's business, even in a situation which is admittedly unsatisfactory to both parties and to the country. This afternoon, I was talking to my colleague David Schoenbrunn in Paris. He tells me that the strikes in France have produced no tension. There is no disorder. There are no political implications. This is a matter of the first direct collective bargaining in France for more than 10 years. Late tonight, Alexander Chandrick arrived in London. He witnessed the trial of Robert Faulkner in Budapest and has surveyed the scene where Captain Eugene Karp died in a railway tunnel near Salzburg. Tomorrow night, you will be with me to report upon these two dramatic and mysterious developments. This is Edward R. Murrow recording from London. Now back to Bob Dixon in New York.
Larry, did you have something more you wanted to say?
Yes, Bob, since Ed Murrow isn't here, I can speak frankly. I'd like to tell our listeners that in the current Reader's Digest, there's a superb article about Ed called He Has America by the Ears. Some of you may have seen it when it appeared originally in the Saturday Evening Post. But if you missed it, I'm sure you'll find it most interesting and enjoyable reading. It's in the Marsh issue of Reader's Digest. And now, Bob, it's your turn.
Thanks, Larry. Say, friends, here's something to sing about.
Oh, the handiest thing on your kitchen shelf is Campbell's tomato soup. Great for lunch and supper, too. Your folks will like it, and most folks do. Especially now in cold or sleet. You want to serve it off and it can't be beat. Yes, the handiest thing on your kitchen shelf is Campbell's tomato soup.
Handy for youngsters' lunches, family suppers, company dinners. The soup most folks like best. Folks like piping hot bowls of Campbell's tomato soup on raw, cold days like these. It adds summer sunshine to winter meals. And it's extra nourishing, extra tempting, when fixed with milk instead of water. Serve it often, Mother. Campbell's tomato soup. The handiest thing on your kitchen shelf. Now here's Ed Murrow's word for today.
Well, Bob, it has been said that a politician thinks of the next election, a statesman of the next generation. I suppose we can assume that both Mr. Attlee and Mr. Churchill are thinking of the next generation. But I assume they would both agree with the warrior statesman who said several hundred years before either one of them came over the horizon, the enemy came, he was beaten, I am tired, good night. Good night. And good luck.
Tune in your Campbell newscaster, Edward R. Murrow, immediately following Dick Hames' Club 15 over most of these stations at this time tomorrow.
Blow the whistle and get on the track of Campbell's pork and beans. Cause once you try them, you'll never go back to any other beans. Campbell's are top, so get them today. Give them a try and you're gonna save for flavor and zest. The beans that are best are Campbell's pork and beans.
Millions buy them, try them, and never go back to ordinary beans. Get the best. Get Campbell's pork and beans.
Listen to Murrow tomorrow. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.